From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update on news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, welcome back. A pleasure as always. A busy time down there, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks, Don. It's good to be talking to you again. And as usual, there's so much going on, it's hard to know where to start. But I mean, perhaps we should start with a very important and sad bit of news for us here in Nicaragua, which was the passing of Padre Miguel Descoto on last Thursday. He died last Thursday after a relapse. He'd been in ill health for many years, but we thought that he'd survive another few years, and unfortunately he didn't.
And he's a Mary Knoll priest who was the foreign minister of Nicaragua and the so-called Polish Pope. Pope John Paul II actually suspended his ability to say Mass and all of those different things because he refused to stay out of politics, in essence.
Right. Yeah, and he was, and Miguel was also the 63rd president. The president of the 63rd UN General Assembly. Back in, I think he was elected in September of 2008.
Wow.
And so he saw through, he presided over the UN General Assembly through the period of the coup in Honduras.
Wow.
And also he and his team put together a commission of economists to devise a proposal to reform the international financial system, and many very eminent economists and people like Joseph Stiglitz and many others, and that proposal was vetoed by the United States government and its allies. And he was also very active environmentally. He was very much an opponent of the way the International Climate Summit system was effectively dismantling the Kyoto Agreement, the Kyoto Protocol, because the Kyoto Protocol was a binding agreement, and the United States and its allies were opposed to that because they didn't want to be part of a binding agreement. Miguel was also very active trying to defend the whole UN structure that was trying to protect the world from the effects of climate change, among other things. And he was a key figure in all of that. But in the region, the reason, apart from all of that, apart from all his major contributions in those areas, the reason why, in my opinion, Padre Miguel was such a historically important figure is because back in the 1980s, he was the individual who worked with his team in the Nicaraguan government and also with international support to bring a... He did two things. He created the Esquipulas peace process, and he brought a case in the International Court of Justice against the United States, which is unprecedented, for accusing the United States of terrorism and promoting terrorist attacks against the Nicaraguan government.
Which was all true.
Which was all true, and the International Court of Justice ruled accordingly and condemned the United States for its acts of terror against the Nicaraguan state. And that was absolutely unprecedented. And the United States still, to this day, has not honored its obligations in relation to that sentence, because the International Court of Justice ordered the United States to pay an indemnity back in 1986 of $17 billion.
Wow.
And that has still not been paid, of course. But it's still, that's still a live claim from the point of view of the Nicaraguan state.
Maybe they can file a judgment against them and seize some of their bank accounts, or maybe Fort Knox or something.
Well, who knows? But politically, what happens is that Daniel Ortega makes the point that so-called U.S. aid is merely a down payment against that original sentence from the International Court of Justice, plus accumulated interest, which, work it out for yourself from 1986 onwards.
Much was it? How many billion?
17.
17 billion. So any of you lawyers out there that do collection work, of course, you customarily keep a third of whatever you recover. So if somebody wants to get to work and go work that judgment, you could make some money, I bet.
Right, that would be sweet. Okay, so there's that Padre Miguel Descoto was the intellectual architect of a major international legal precedent won by the Nicaraguan government. But more importantly, from the point of view of contemporary developments in Latin America and the Caribbean, Miguel Descoto promoted the Esquipulas peace process back in the 1980s that was designed not just to bring an end to the Nicaraguan war promoted by the United States, but was also intended to provide a framework for the peaceful resolution of the war in El Salvador and the war in Guatemala at the time. And the three components of that Esquipulas peace process were no U.S. presence in the negotiations between the governments taking part, a commitment from the governments to an institutional framework that would set a fixed calendar of meetings so that the process would not die. And the third element was a commitment on the parts of the participating governments to regional integration and to peace. And so those three components, if you think about it, those three components that Papa Miguel and his team promoted back then in the Esquipulas peace process are the key components of what is now the community of Latin American and Caribbean states, of the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, and the almost every regional process that you can think of down here in Latin America and the Caribbean.
It's almost like a Chavez program, or
well, yes, and how old was Chavez back then? What was happening with Chavez back then in the 1980s? He was a young army officer who was watching all this with passionate interest.
Gotcha. Yep, he was getting schooled at that time. That's right.
Yeah. And Fidel too, who was certainly very much part of the conversations, because Padre Miguel was a passionate supporter of the Cuban Revolution, and he recognized the massive contribution of Fidel and the Cuban Revolution to regional autonomy and emancipation. And so that Esquipulas peace process was driven by the vision of Padre Miguel and his team, Daniel Ortega and his team, back then. And so often you hear from the corporate media that the most important player in that process was Oscar Arias, who subsequently won a Nobel Peace Prize for his role in that. Completely spurious, completely false. And the people who were driving that process, Oscar Arias was actually trying to put a brake on it. And the people who were driving that process were Padre Miguel, Daniel Ortega, and Vinicio Cerezo, the Guatemalan president at the time. Right? And they were the intellectual authors of the Esquipulas peace process that finally brought peace to the process against the wishes of the United States.
That's right.
The United States government at the time, under Ronald Reagan and under subsequently under George Bush, they detested the Esquipulas peace process. Of course they did, because they were excluded from it. because the players recognized, the governments recognized Vinicio Cerezo of Guatemala, Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua, Jose Ascone in Honduras, and often derided for his role, but it has to be acknowledged that Jose Maria Ascone, I think that is his name, was his willingness to participate in Escapulas was crucial, as was the willingness of the Salvadoran president at the time. And Oscar Arias tagged along, because if he didn't, he'd have been made to look really stupid. But anyway, I mean, that peace process was the forerunner of everything that Hugo Chavez and Fidel and Evo Morales and Rafael Correa and Daniel Ortega and the others have brought to fruition now.
Yep.
And so the current developments that we're seeing now have their roots in, and of course, and that we're talking about everything is relative. I mean, where do you stop? Where do you mark the beginning and end of a historical process? Because as Miguel Descoto himself and his colleagues, his contemporaries, leading historians and diplomats like Aldo Diaz Lacayo down here in Nicaragua, they make the point that whole process is very much part of the Bolivarian independence movement that started back in the early 19th century. And yeah. Simón Bolívar very consciously made peace a central part of his proposals and vision. And so that's, you know, I'm Miguel Descoto. His contribution was to breathe new life into those Bolivarian ideas and into the ideals of Martí and Sandino, and that was his great contribution. If people look back, I mean, why was, and ask the question, well, why was Miguel Descoto important? That was why.
You know, at the time that he was elected to chair the General Assembly for 2008 and 2009. If you think about that, you have the financial collapse taking place also, you know, in the Western countries, certainly, and that was felt throughout this hemisphere. So there's an interview that somebody at the National Catholic Register did. It's linked, I think, to an article that you sent me. Maybe, I don't remember how I got it, but it points out, you know, this is written at that time, so it mentioned the fact that there's this ongoing economic crisis. So it says, Padre Miguel says, people need to regain confidence in their governments and financial institutions, but that won't occur without the full participation of all member states in responding to the crisis. So he's organizing at this moment, walking into the job, like the restructuring of a new economic order and what he's wanted to set up as profound democratization of the UN.
Right.
That's what he walked in saying.
He and Evo Morales and Rafael Correa and Daniel Ortega and Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro now, they all believe fervently in the need to reinvent the UN. In fact, there's Padre Miguel and his team produced a book called Reinventing the United Nations. Because they recognize that what we're living through is it's a crisis of capitalism, but it's a crisis of the institutional arrangements,
right,
that have existed over the last 50 years to at the behest of the major capitalist powers, the United States and Western Europe. And that has to change. When people talk about the economic crisis in 2008, they often forget or make it seem marginal, when in fact it's not. It's absolutely central. That the corollary, I don't like using the word inevitable, but, and like so many people, but
yeah, I got you.
I'd say the inevitable corollary of the economic crisis was the environmental crisis and the breakdown in the agreements around how to protect the global environment.
Right. Yep.
And all those things have come together, and I think what we're seeing here in here, certainly here in the region, but also perhaps globally, is a trend towards recognizing that conventional political institutions, the institutions that of Western representative democracy, are deeply broken. You know, and you can see that in so many events around the world.
You said 50 years, but what event or what environment are you beginning in? Because I'm thinking a lot of these structures are 70 something. You know, World War.
Oh yes, sorry. Of course, I'm 1945 is the key date,
right,
isn't it?
Okay.
The end of the Second World War, the founding of the United Nations, the Bretton Woods institutions, IMF, World Bank, the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade that later became the World Trade Organization. And yeah, you're right, it's 70 years.
Yep, yeah, they set the stage for a whole lot of stuff. Yeah, well, I know, I make the same mistake because we were talking about these things when it was 50 years ago, too, and 40 years ago, so, because we're old.
Right. So then, you know, that's why the death of Padre Miguel was so significant in regional terms, and for so many people who knew him personally, he was such an outstanding, wonderful person.
But even in global terms, I mean, we're talking about, you know, he was in a key position with a mission in mind of crisis in the world economic system and other systems. He recognized that there had to be major changes, and he was, you know, working on a plan for that, walking into that job. So I'm sure there's an impact.
He was a very he had great humility, Don.
Yeah.
And he'd if people would go to his house and he'd prepare meals for them.
Nice. Nice guy. He's just a
nice guy. No, and look at that. What other person of his stature? I'm sure there are, but I can't think of any people with that reputation, you know. would just go into the kitchen and start doing a potato salad for somebody.
Yeah, let me get you something. Let me feed you. Hang on a second. It's nice. By the way, folks, the gentleman we're talking about, who was the foreign minister of Nicaragua, who was an early and leading liberation theologist, who was the president of the General Assembly for 2008 and 2009. He was born in Los Angeles in February of 1933. He's from the United States, although I think
went to high school in Berkeley.
Okay. So there. So not all Americans are evil, nasty dictators. Some of them leave and do good stuff. Oh. And he was a Mary Knoller. He's from right here in Austin, New York, Mary Knoll's headquarters.
Right.
So go ahead.
Maybe we should move on to the what's happening now in the broader scene.
Yeah. We've got about 11 minutes, so let's do that.
Yeah, so the big news over the weekend was for many people, certainly people committed to anti-imperialism, was the failure of the Puerto Rico referendum.
Yep.
And which here in Nicaragua is a big deal because Daniel Ortega has been perhaps the most vocal Latin American leader advocating independence for Puerto Rico. And of course, that's even more relevant now with the recent liberation of Oscar López Rivera. The great Puerto Rican nationalist, and the referendum is being touted as a legitimation of Puerto Rico's request to become a state of the United States. What is it, the 51st?
51st it would be.
But in fact, only 28% of people voted in the referendum.
Yeah, 28% turnout.
Sorry, 28% of the population turned out, right?
Yeah.
Largely because there was in part because of apathy, but also in more importantly because of the boycott by the movements calling for Puerto Rican independence. So that was, and looked at from any reasonable point of view, that was a massive failure.
Yep.
For the people who want to incorporate Puerto Rico into the United States.
So that
was very important. Down in Brazil, there was a, do you remember we were talking about the case going through the Supreme Court on illicit campaign funding for Dilma Rousseff and the current usurper president Temer's ticket back in 2014?
Mm-hmm.
And that case, if it had gone against Temer and Dilma Rousseff, that would have forced new elections of one kind or another,
yeah.
Either indirect elections in the Brazilian legislature, or direct elections, direct national elections. And the Supreme Court came out with a decision exonerating Dilma and Temer's campaign of the allegation, the accusation of illicit campaign financing. But man, a lot of people are very cynical about that because they think that the judges were influenced by extreme right-wing opinion, or right-wing opinion generally in Brazil, and the opinion of the Brazilian elites, that they don't want an election now, because if there were an election now, all the polls show that Lula Ignacio da Silva, the Workers' Party candidate, would win outright without a second round.
Mm-hmm.
So that says a lot of cynicism around that decision, and in Brazil the scandals keep piling up, the Petrobras scandal, the scandal over corrupt payments by the big JBS.
Mm.
Meatpacking company, that multinational meatpacking company.
Huge.
And so it's not clear at all how things are going to pan out, because although Temer is safe for the moment, it's only a brief respite from the looks of things, because there's so much scandal around his usurper government. And it's in any case, there are going to be elections in 2018. And so it remains to be seen how the right-wing Brazilian elites are going to prevent what looks like an inevitable victory for Lula Ignacio da Silva and the Workers' Party in 2018, if he's able to stand.
I don't get something with this, with the case with Temer, for example. You know, you've got this essentially crisis of legitimacy for the institutions in Brazil. The country has been divided like almost 50-50 for a good long time. Except for the end, his successor, Dilma Rousseff, they were able to govern. I mean, the right wing was throwing everything at it, and they were able to govern. But Temer hasn't been able to govern, and he's probably, with his numbers, if he's not the most unpopular politician in the history of the world, he's in the top 10 probably. And so this court, knowing that he's a sinking ship in terms of support, where there's already a crisis of legitimacy in all of the institutions, including the courts, I can't understand how they hitch themselves to his star, which is falling.
Well, and Temer may be unable to govern from a conventional point of view, but from the right wing, from the point of view of the right wing elites, he's done what they wanted him to do, which is he pushed through legislation freezing social payments on social programs for 20 years. And he's pushed through privatization of the pre-sal. Not the outright privatization, but the opening up of the pre-sal deposits, these tremendous, huge deposits of oil in the the Atlantic in Brazil's territorial waters, and they've opened that up to foreign investment, which is something that Lula and Dilma Rousseff had resisted in order to defend the patrimony of the Brazilian people.
Yeah, from the beginning of the discovery of that fund, you know, is it the largest in the world or one of the largest?
In the world. And very, very expensive to pull out of the ground. Yeah. So right now, with oil prices where they are, it's probably not economic to do an extensive development of those.
Right.
To do an extensive development of those pre-sale resources, but you know the oil market's so volatile from one year to the next that, and it's perfectly possible that they'll become very economically profitable within the next 2 or 3 years. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But that and the point is that Temer has done the job that the Brazilian elites wanted him to do. Now it's just a question of what political resolution will there be to this wave of corruption scandals that is threatening the political institutions in Brazil and all the institutions. And I thought it was very ironic that Luis Almagro a couple of weeks ago said that the difference between Brazil and Venezuela is that because back then there were big demonstrations in Brazil protesting against the Temer government. And he said that the difference between Venezuela and Brazil is Brazil's institutional stability, which is a joke.
Even the New York Times is saying that the institution. They have a quote from David Fleischer from the University of Brasilia. He says, "The ruling shows that Brazil's institutions are not working that well."
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the New York Times. It's a little weak, but even they have to admit that that's true.
And whereas on the other hand, in Venezuela, despite everything, as I knew you were saying in a conversation we had earlier, despite everything that all the NATO country governments, the US and its allies, all the local right-wing governments like Colombia and Mexico, and the right-wing regimes now in Brazil and Argentina, despite everything that they've done to try and isolate Venezuela and encourage the terrorist extremist Venezuelan opposition in its campaign to overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro. And Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues have maintained their position and they have demonstrated how robust the political institutions are in Venezuela that are a result of the constitutional assembly that created the Venezuelan constitution in 1999 under the guidance of Comandante Hugo Chavez. I mean, what's so ironic is, if you look at what's happening internationally, where in the world is there the most repressive legislation attacking civil rights?
Yeah.
In France,
right.
The Emmanuel Macron has declared that he's going to make the state of siege legislation that was passed following the attack on what's that magazine?
Hebdo.
Hebdo, Charlie Hebdo. After those attacks in Paris against the Charlie Hebdo magazine, the government of François Hollande brought in a state of siege.
Yep.
Macron has said that he's going to legislate to make that state of siege permanent.
Yep. This is the kind of stuff that triggered a few French revolutions in my memory, not my personal memory, but in the history books.
But in Venezuela,
it's the opposite.
The level of violent terrorist protests, which in France would have met with the most savage repression.
Yep.
Never mind the United States.
Yep.
Or Germany, and any of those countries. Yep. And even so, in Venezuela, there's still no state of siege. There's still no emergency legislation depriving people of civil rights.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. for Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.